This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. I guess the way to sum all this up is it sure could have been worse. Although if you're living in Florida, I'm not sure you would agree with that statement. But the wrath of Hurricane Irma could have been worse down there. As the largest storm in Atlantic hurricane history raged across the ocean, it scraped the northern coast of Cuba, weakening it and turning it just enough to make a meaningful difference in the kind of damage it would do to South Florida. It also spared us. For a while, we were in the path of Irma, and although we're still experiencing its wind gusts and rain, things here, too, could have been much worse. Still, this has been a bad hurricane season by any measure. Harvey crippled a major American city with the kind of rain and flooding rarely seen. Irma set records for size, power, endurance, and destruction. And there are 2 months left in hurricane season. Is this the new normal? What should we learn from these storms? What kind of preparations can we, should we, make? We spend the hour talking about that, and we begin with WCNC-TV Chief Meteorologist Brad Panovich, who joins us via Skype. Welcome back, Brad.
Thanks for having me.
You're a regular guest now. And we're also joined by Steve Wilkinson, a meteorologist in charge from the National Weather Service Greenville-Spartanburg offices. Steve, thank you for being here as well.
Hi, Mike. Thank you for having me.
We are, Brad, where are the remnants of Irma right now? Where's the center, if there still is one, of this tropical storm?
It is, yeah. Now it's down to a tropical storm, Mike. And it's kind of in just south of Tallahassee, Florida right now, kind of in that general area. And it's moving northwest into southern Georgia. So it's going to be in Georgia most of today, down there south of Macon, kind of near Valdosta area. And then it's going to move over into eastern parts of Alabama as we go into tomorrow morning, and eventually weaken and become a remnant low by Wednesday morning in somewhere in western Tennessee area. It kind of merges with an upper level low, kind of a normal system we would have here over the U.S. and kind of meanders there, moves up into the Ohio Valley. So we might see it on the weather maps here for a couple of days, but it's going to be a shell of itself.
So, Steve, I was watching a little TV and then listening to radio, so I'm not exactly sure where I heard this morning, but I know that in Jacksonville, Florida, which is on the east coast of Florida, the northeastern coast of Florida, they're experiencing serious storm surge, and some of the people talking about that seem surprised by this, given where Irma is. Why are they experiencing storm surge?
Well, as Brad mentioned, the center is well to the west of Jacksonville, but the strongest part of this storm at this point is actually over, say, the Jacksonville area going up to maybe Savannah and Georgia, kind of the coastal Georgia area. And that's because the flow, based on where the storm is all onshore. And so you're still getting wind gusts 65 miles per hour or so in the Jacksonville area straight onshore. And so what it's doing is taking that water and just blowing it, you know, at the beaches inland, but also in the inlets, the rivers, that you're just getting a push of water that's coming in. So I believe that was anticipated, but obviously it's hard to communicate sometimes exactly what the impacts are going to be. So the real point to carry forward from this, and what we tell people all the time, is don't focus on that center exclusively. Mm-hmm. Realize that the impacts of the storm are well away from the center.
And one thing about we learned about hurricanes this time around, again, I guess it's reinforced by Irma, was the fact that you really can't predict with any complete accuracy exactly where it will go or what it will do, because I know that on Friday we were looking at the utter destruction of Miami Beach, and although I'm sure when the sun fully reveals the damage of the weekend, they'll have significant damage to deal with. It would have been nothing like a Category 4 slamming into those skyscrapers on Miami Beach, and that's because the storm changed direction. Did that surprise anybody? Because we were supposed to get some significant, perhaps, storm effects here had the storm not changed direction. Brad?
Yeah, I think it changed a little. I think, like Steve was talking about, I think one of the things that I've noticed with this storm is an obsession with where the center line of the track is. And in reality, if you look at the National Hurricane Center forecast tracks, which go out just 5 days, which is 120 hours, they've had a pretty good forecast track. I would say above average compared to the last 5 years. And that reason we do that cone, everyone's really used to seeing that cone on TV and online. We show it a lot. That's where the center could be, somewhere in that cone and not in the center line. And each subsequent forecast, usually about 70% of the time, the next forecast is always within that cone somewhere. Now, it shifts a little bit east and west. Mm-hmm. But the thing about Florida, it's such a narrow state. So subtle changes in that shift brought the center, you know, 50 miles further west than 50 miles further east is the difference between being on shore and in the middle of the state. So those subtle changes were just kind of exaggerated because of the geography of Florida as well.
And, of course, Irma was bigger than the state of Florida.
It was huge, you know, and most hurricanes are because Florida is so narrow. But this, the wind field expanded. It's almost, I think, like 400 or 500 miles wide now with the tropical storm force winds. They extend from Florida all the way to the North Carolina border now.
Florida's governor at some time this weekend was still telling residents to prepare for the most catastrophic storm the state has ever seen. Was it, Brad?
We probably won't know until it's completely gone. I think the one thing that may make it pretty close to that is because it affected the entire state. I think the scary thing about the Miami situation is, unlike Andrew, which sliced from east to west just south of downtown Miami, if Irma would have taken that turn a little bit sooner, it would have brought Category 4 winds into the entire length of Miami-Dade County, which would have impacted an area that has been, developed tenfold since Andrew. And I think that was always the fear, is that is an area that has exploded in growth, and taking a direct hit from a major hurricane like that could have been could ended up being the worst disaster that state has ever seen. And we may still end up there, unfortunately. It just depends on how things unfold after the fact and we find out what all the damage is.
Steve, Brad mentioned a second ago that we've gotten better at predicting these storms and where they're going, and we seem to really have gotten better at this. We got this one slightly wrong, but that's because it changed. How much better have we gotten, and how have we gotten better?
Well, one of the things that is worth pointing out here is the cone that was talked about earlier. The cone is actually the average error in storms in the past years. I forget exactly how many years that is. But essentially, when you get out to, say, day four, there's an average error for the forecast versus the landfall, the actual landfall, over a period of time. And so what you see is those cones are getting smaller and smaller because the forecasting is getting better and better. Now, having said that, just like Brad described, at one point it was going to go just up the east coast and ended up just going up the west coast. And if you figure that was about maybe a day 4, day 5 forecast before it really shifted to be pretty much right on what happened, that's pretty good. There's been a tremendous improvement. Now, of course, if you're in Miami and you it wasn't nearly as bad, which is probably a good thing, of course, but you go, well, how do I make decisions on that? And that's the challenge, is who do we evacuate, because the impacts change so much based on the, 100 miles difference.
Have we gotten better because we have better technology, more satellites? Have we gotten better because we understand these storms more?
I think it's all of the above. I mean, there's an investment in the satellite technology. There's an investment in, of course, we've been flying planes into them for years. But, this the technology with all these things is continuing to improve. There are more and more models that, while they still offer a broad variety of solutions, they're still kind of honing in, and you're getting better and better information. Still, obviously, there's room to improve. But I think you are seeing an overall improvement in the last 10 years, 20 years.
The media is often criticized for hyping events like this and for having reporters out in the worst conditions imaginable and putting their lives in danger in many cases while they're telling us, don't come outside. did we overblow this thing, Brad, or did we do the right thing?
I think for the most part we did the right thing. But I'll be honest, I've seen some in the media go a little crazy with it as well. I'm not a big fan of all these people standing out in the storm. Having done it myself for many years, in 2005 hurricane season, I was in Katrina, Rita, and Wilma, three of the strongest storms ever hit the U.S. I can tell you it's not fun, because you're kind of in the same setup that everybody that's living there is. So I do think there's some of that going on, but I also think this, we've been, until Harvey, it's been 12 years since we've had a major hurricane hit the U.S., and now we've had two back-to-back ones in this season, and social media and the digital age has exploded since that, 12 years when Wilma hit Florida. So I think a lot of that has changed how the perception and how these things are covered. And like Steve was mentioning, I think one of the most difficult things I see as a meteorologist and forecaster is the communication of these things. You know, how do we communicate a forecast? Even a great forecast sometimes could be misconstrued if it's not communicated correctly.
Right. Because, well, Irma was the most powerful. I think we talked about this on Friday when you were on with us on the news roundup, but Brad, Irma was the most powerful hurricane, I said, in recorded history in the Atlantic, and I think you corrected me slightly on that.
Yeah, it was outside the Gulf and the Caribbean. The strongest hurricane in the Atlantic Basin was actually Hurricane Allen in 1980. So it set the record for outside of the Gulf and the Caribbean.
And it's the longest ever to remain a Category 5. Am I right about that?
Yes, yes. The duration of that was rather impressive.
So, Steve, what led to those records?
Well, I think you had a perfect environment. A hurricane needs the warm waters of the ocean, obviously, and you have that a lot. So it was in a very warm environment. And you had a wave that came off Africa that from day one, Hurricane Center was looking at very closely as a strong development area. And then you just look at the upper level winds, which were, you know, pretty much on the light side. And so when the winds at the higher levels are light, that allows this engine that really is a hurricane to just taking the heat content from the ocean and developing this structure of a storm, and while being so calm in the middle, just being so violent right around it, that just the conditions in the lower levels and the upper levels were very favorable. And you can see overall, you had Jose form as well in that same general pattern, and then the one that formed off Texas, Katia, I believe it was called, a few days ago. So again, you had three hurricanes going at the same time because the upper level pattern was very favorable for formation. What? And again, this is peak season. I mean, we're within a day or two of the absolute peak. So this is the time of year you would expect to be most active. Yeah.
I think September the 10th is the peak day.
Right. So it yesterday,
was yesterday.
Right?
Yeah. National Geographic reports that although Harvey and Irma have brought rare devastation, this overall hurricane season is less unusual than we might think. Do you agree with that, Steve?
Yeah, I think we have to remember, like Brad was saying, I think he said it was 12 years since we've had a major hurricane. And so if you remember back to 2004 and 5, I mean, those were really hyperactive years. I think 5, we went into the Greek alphabet, so we just had a tremendous amount of activity. And then, you know, so many of them were hitting the Gulf Coast or the East Coast during that period. So I can remember, I personally was in Charleston in 2004, and I mean, every weekend for like 4 or 5 weekends, we were gearing up for some kind of impact. It wasn't always a direct impact, but maybe it was the periphery. And so got to kind of look at this in a long-term perspective. We really had a long-term, to use a drought, I don't want to use the word, in a lack of rainfall sense, but in a lack of major hurricanes and significant landfalls. And now we're getting into a year which was like 2004 or 5 in some ways because you had major impacts. So I think looking at it long term that you're going to have these cycles, and we probably shouldn't overreact too much to an active year.
The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration predicted that this year would see 14 to 19 named storms and 5 to 9 hurricanes. I have about 20 seconds left. Has that prediction proven to be accurate, and is that normal?
Well, it's been an active season, that's for sure. I'd have to remember what. We're up to K now, so however many letters that is. I can't think on the fly here, but it is obviously very active. And you know, just because we're at the peak now, we still have all the way to the end of November.
Okay, let me stop you there because we have to take a break. We'll come back with more with Brad Panovich and Steve Wilkinson in just a second at Charlotte Talks. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and the UNCC College of Arts and Architecture presenting the Faculty Dance Concert September 15th and 16th, featuring contemporary African and multimedia performances by faculty and guests. More at arts.uncc.edu. And Live Nation presenting Garrison Keillor's Prairie Home Love and Comedy Tour Thursday, September 14th, Belk Theater at Blumenthal Performing Arts Center. Tickets at livenation.com. Prospects of a nuclear renaissance in the U.S. have been dealt a series of setbacks. South Carolina utilities abandoned a project this summer after sinking billions of dollars into it and passing some of the costs along to customers. Duke Energy also canceled projects in South Carolina and in Florida. Guest host David Borax will be here tomorrow at 9, along with industry experts, to look at why the nuclear comeback is fizzling out. That's tomorrow on this program at 9.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. Coming up on the next On Point, Hurricane Irma, how we're dealing and what we're learning from an Atlantic monster. That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
That's On Point this morning from 10 to noon, right after Charlotte Talks, on listener-funded public radio, 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking to WCNC-TV Chief Meteorologist Brad Panovich, along with Steve Wilkinson, meteorologist in charge of the National Weather Service office at the Greenville-Spartanburg Airport, which ought to be here, by the way, Steve, but that's another story. That's a whole other show. What role, if any, does El Niño, is El Niño playing? What does it play in the role of Atlantic hurricanes? Brad, take that one, if you will.
Yeah, El Niño-La Niña cycle has a huge impact on the activity in the tropical Atlantic. Actually, it has a pretty big impact on the Pacific as well. But usually when we have strong El Niños, we tend to have some lesser storms in the Atlantic. La Niña, we tend to get a little bit more activity. But what we found over the last couple years is the activity doesn't always relate to impacts on the U.S. I mean, one of the things that we talk about early in the season when these hurricane seasonal forecasts are issued, a lot of times someone will see that number of storms that is forecasted and think that looks like a bad season. Well, to us, I think the definition of a bad season is like what we're seeing now is impacts on the U.S. If you think about when Andrew hit in 1992, I think most Americans would admit that that was a bad year because Andrew hit South Florida and eventually Louisiana. That was one of only six or seven storms that formed that entire season. And then you have seasons like, in the late 2000s when we had 15, 16, 18 storms, but they were what we all call fish storms. They were out in the middle of the Atlantic. So when we look at the El Niño, La Niña cycle, it gives us a kind of a hint at the activity. But one of the things we want to know is the steering currents. Where are the storms going? If we get the correct steering currents at the peak of the season, we could have one storm after another head into the U.S. So I think that's really the thing that we're trying to grasp is, how do we figure out the steering currents ahead of time for the upcoming season?
Now, these storms, these hurricanes and in the Pacific, with the cyclones, do they always move east to west?
Not always. Okay. Late in the season, sometimes in the Caribbean, they'll move west to east because the flow will start going that way. But typically, especially in the peak of the season, early in the season, we've got the east to west flow. That's what the tropical wave train, we like to call it. It's these clusters of thunderstorms that come off the African coast, and they will move across the tropics. Mm-hmm. And as they get up in latitude, which is further north, they get closer to the westerlies, which are the west to east flow we're typical to. And that's why you see so many recurvatures as it gets close to the U.S., because they start to get north. They wrap around that big subtropical high, which is out in the middle of the Atlantic, and they start to recurve. The other thing is cold fronts and troughs that come down tend to pick them up and recurve. So if you look climatologically, that's why you have so many storms that approach the U.S. and then make that turn to the north and northeast.
And before I get back to Steve, I want to ask you a question about the word cyclone. This hurricane season, I'm hearing meteorologists, and I think I heard it first on your television station, Brad, refer to this as a cyclone. And I always thought that cyclones were hurricanes in the Pacific and hurricanes are hurricanes in the Atlantic. Are they one and the same? Have we changed our terminology? What's going on here?
We have.
What are you people up to?
Maybe publicly we've said this year there's a new product. It's a new product that the Hurricane Center puts out when they have high confidence that a potential tropical cyclone will impact the U.S. We put out what's called a potential tropical cyclone track. And we in meteorology have always called these tropical cyclones, which are these type of storms that occur over tropical waters. That's the meteorological term. In fact, all storm systems really that move across the country are referred to as cyclones. We call them mid-latitude cyclones, or, you know, in winter storms are technically cyclones. But we change the names a little bit. In the Atlantic, we call them hurricanes. The Eastern Pacific, hurricanes. The Western Pacific, we call them typhoons. And in the Indian Ocean and South Pacific, we call them cyclones. But technical term-wise, they're all tropical cyclones. That if you look at any kind of journals on the science of tropical meteorology, they're all tropical cyclones.
Okay, so let's talk about what's going on with Harvey and Irma here. We have these two major hurricanes that have done billions of dollars, long-lasting damage in two, in one major American city, and now the entire state of Florida, which includes a lot of big-sized cities, Orlando and Jacksonville and Tampa, St. Pete, and Miami, and, of course, the Florida Keys, etc. Is this the new normal? Is this these enormous storms, and not just the storms, the droughts in the West a few seasons ago, the extreme snow they got a couple of years ago in the northern tier of states, is this all part of climate change, Steve?
Well, again, I mentioned this earlier, that keeping a long-term perspective is important. You know, it may be. Honestly, I'm probably not qualified to say that for sure. I'd probably need to be someone who's really studying that on a daily basis. But, you know, if you look at it from a long-term perspective, there have been extreme events. Not only hurricanes, you go back in the 20s, and Florida Keys was hit by a major hurricane, Galveston, 1900. And, you know, in history, long before we were ever even in this continent, there was a lot of stuff going on, almost certainly. So, you know, I would probably maybe be cautious in that sense, not to jump the gun too much, but, you know, things seem like they're happening frequently, so we have to kind of pay attention and definitely be prepared. That's kind of, you know, it's hard for me to give a definite answer on that, but we just encourage preparedness. If it's a trend toward worse, then we want people to be prepared for it. If it's just continuing kind of a normal cycle of every 10 or 20 years you get some active periods, then even so, there's still reason to be prepared.
So what kind of impact can we expect in this region from Charlotte through the mountains because of tropical storm, the remnants of Hurricane Irma?
Right. Well, you know, there's some light rain spreading across the area right now. It's actually kind of fighting the dry air that we've had the beautiful days the last few days. So it's kind of just piddling around out there a little bit right now. But the heavier rain is going to get going here by afternoon and spreading in, you know, into the overnight period.
And
you know,
winds?
Somewhere a couple inches of rain, certainly not out of the question. And if certain banding sets up, we may get some localized heavier amounts, but some, you know, wind gusts 30, 35 miles per hour. So overall, could have been a whole lot worse, but certainly a breezy, rainy day.
Okay. And Brad, I know this is not necessarily your bailiwick, but what kind of winter can we expect here in Charlotte? Because we're on the verge of it now. We've had these two big storms. Are we going to get lots of snow? What's going on?
You know, it's funny. I usually try to do my winter forecast in late October as we get ready for the season. And one of the things I always like to see when I do my forecast, I kind of like to see how the hurricane season shaked out, because it's kind of interesting to see how the patterns in hurricane season can end up, you know, transferring to the winter season. But right now, I mean, looking at the trend the last couple of years, we've had pretty warm winters. We have not had a really cold winter in a long time. And one of the things that this time of year you want to start looking for hints is it's one of these things. It sounds weird, but it's snowfall over in Siberia. You start looking at snowfall patterns in the fall in northern Siberia. And if they have above average snowfall in September and October, we tend to get more cold air on the East Coast. So that's something I'm going to keep an eye on here in the next couple of months. But really, it takes us to get a little bit through the fall season before you have a really good grasp on it. But just based on the last year trends, the last couple of years, I have a sneaky feeling it's going to probably be pretty close to average, maybe a little bit above average. But just like with hurricanes, you know, we could have a warm winter and have one or two storms time out with some cold air, and you end up with some big storms even in the midst of a pretty mild winter.
Still,
right. If I could jump in, that's exactly right. He mentioned that about the hurricanes and the tropical systems. You could have a very active year, and yet maybe it doesn't hit this area. Same kind of thing for winter. It could be cold, but dry, you know, no major snows or anything.
So you're still in an inexact science. Let's get it together, gentlemen. Let's make this an exact science, shall we? Steve Wilkinson is meteorologist in charge at the National Weather Service office in Greenville-Spartanburg, where our radar is located, though it should move here. I'll say it one more time. And Brad Panovich, chief meteorologist at WCNC-TV, NBC6. He joined us via Skype. Thank you both for being here. I appreciate it.
All right. Thank you, Mike.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Aside from the flooding in coastal areas caused by storm surge from hurricanes, these storms bring lots of rain. That also causes flooding, of course. And, of course, Harvey is the granddaddy of them all now when it comes to rain and flooding. That storm took a lot of people in Houston by complete surprise. Would we have been able to handle that kind of rain? If faced with a storm like that in the future, what would the impact on Charlotte be? Well, Mark Boone may know the answer to that question and many others. He's from Charlotte-Mecklenburg Stormwater Services. Thank you for being here this morning.
Good morning.
Morning. Since Irma chose not to visit us to any great degree, we're going to talk about something other than what we might have been talking about this morning had she dropped in on us, flooding. Harvey inundated Houston with more rain than most of us can possibly imagine. I've heard all kinds of ways to compare this rainfall, and I think one thing I heard was that it was enough rain to supply New York City for all of its drinking water for 69 years.
Wow.
I mean, that's unbelievable to me. So what would happen, what would have happened if Harvey sat on top of Charlotte?
It's difficult to speculate something like that. First of all, our hearts go out to Houston and just seeing the devastation that has actually occurred there. One of the things that we look at is our topography, and it is much different than what you see in Houston. In Houston, you have a much more of a bowl effect, whereas here in the Piedmont, we have topography that lends itself to watershed much more quickly. We're talking about 60 inches of rain in a week's time, less than a week's time, actually. And that level of rain anywhere would cause an incredible amount of flash flooding. We're a riverine area, and so most of that it would go from swollen creeks to both the Catawba as well as the Yadkin watershed. And those water sources would also swell up tremendously.
But we also have dams here for hydroelectric power, and they created Lake Murray and they created Lake Norman and Lake Wiley. I mean, I was in Columbia for a second.
Yeah.
Lake Norman and Lake Wiley, would they have had a problem with that kind of a rain event?
Duke Energy is very good about monitoring water conditions ahead of time. As a matter of fact, they began flow beginning on Friday to discharge some of the water that they were holding in Norman and also in Lake Wiley in anticipation of a considerable rain event. I was there in Columbia in 2015 during Joaquin, and you saw 19 inches of rain in less than, I believe it was 12 hours,
Right. Occur
there. They opened up their floodgate the first time in 50 years. They opened that floodgate, and I have some photos of me standing on top of the dam there as they are letting that go, and it was phenomenal just to see that much water and downstream houses that were completely underwater up to the eaves of the roof.
Wow. Yeah, they also have – I didn't know this. I lived in Columbia for a while. I had no idea they had all these smaller dams scattered around the city, particularly in the Forest Acres area, which is a pretty Tony-sided town for Columbia. And they had flooding because the dams gave way.
That's right. Those were privately owned dams, and the dam owners are the ones that are responsible for maintaining and drawing down levels. And in that unfortunate incident, they were not letting they were not discharging at that time, and that's what caused so much devastation downstream.
A lot of people who lived in Columbia and a lot of people who lived in Houston did not believe or did not know that they lived in a flood-prone area. Some did, and for those people, they probably have the federally mandated flood insurance. But for those who were surprised, why were they surprised? I mean, was it because it is an extraordinary event? And if we can extrapolate that out to Charlotte, are there lots of people who would have been surprised had a hurricane like Harvey sat over us?
To your point, 80% of the victims of Harvey did not have flood insurance.
Should we all have flood insurance, even if we live in an area that's not flood prone?
Of course, I'm going to say yes. But if you are in or adjacent to, you definitely want to have flood insurance. If you look at We have a mentality in so many ways, thinking of years. In other words, this is a 25-year storm. This is a 100-year storm. And that's based on data from a spectrum that's only a couple hundred years old. And so if we looked at, you know, the potential of what would happen with a Harvey event here, folks who were completely out of the floodplain would still be inundated. And so that is a hard lesson for people to learn. So, yes, definitely you want to consider flood insurance. We've been working very hard to make sure that those rates are actually affordable for folks here. We have approximately 5,500 homes in the floodplain in Mecklenburg County at this point.
And do they know that, the people who own those homes?
They are aware of it, as well as we communicate with them regularly. Mm-hmm. There used to be a lot more, and we've done floodplain buyouts where we've actually bought out the property and demolished it.
Wow. I live around some of those areas where they've taken houses out, and now it's a greenway. You have been mapping floodplains in Charlotte. Are you finished with that?
It's an ongoing process. You know,
is this something new? Why did it take us so long to know where these floodplains are?
So floodplains began being regulated in the late 70s.
Okay.
However, as far as us being a cooperating partner with FEMA, we've been doing that since the mid-90s. And we've been mapping an ongoing mapping process ever since then, and we are refreshing that. In fact, later this year, the northeastern quadrant of Mecklenburg County, those maps become active. And so we will continue to update floodplain maps because of both upstream and downstream development.
I was just going to ask about that. Have floodplains changed in either size or character or even location because of development? Because one of the big problems in Houston was they had a lot of spongy areas that have traditionally absorbed a lot of rain, but they've developed and paved them over with impermeable surfaces, and some of that has got to be happening here.
Well, we are encouraging wise development when it comes to developing in the floodplains. We work with developers to make sure that they are aware of the needs for stormwater flow, as well as we consider the impervious areas in our floodplain mapping. We actually not only have our current floodplain map, but we also have the future floodplain maps, which takes into account the zoning that will account for all future development in an area, and that is taken into account when we map the floodplain.
I said in the opening minute of this program that we're going to stick to the Boy Scout motto for part of this program. That's be prepared. And I know that you folks at Stormwater Services have a whole routine for preparation for storms like this. But one of the things, before we talk about that, one of the things that you mentioned off the air to me was that you were listening to another talk radio station earlier last week, and you heard people calling in saying that they were filling their bathtubs with water in advance of this storm, and that was not necessary, you said?
Well, our good friends at Charlotte Water, they have a different intake method than they had in Columbia. In Columbia, they did have to boil water, and there were a lot more things that they had to do to prepare simply because their intake was based on a diversion dam. And whereas the intake for Charlotte Water, and I want to be careful because I don't speak for Charlotte Water, but they put out on their social media that is not something that is necessary for residents in Mecklenburg County to do.
Okay. Mark Boone is with us. He's the spokesperson for Charlotte Mecklenburg Stormwater Services. I want to find out what you guys do in terms of preparation and what happens during a major event and what plans you have for recovery after that event. And then we're going to talk to somebody from the American Red Cross about all of this as well. Stay with us at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Telware, servicing the Carolinas with unified voice data and video solutions since 1984, now offering hosted solutions for small businesses. More info at telware.com. And NC Warn, presenting Clean Path 2025, a strategy to slow climate change, save money, and create jobs with local solar power and battery storage. NCWarn.org. Well, our coverage of Hurricane, now Tropical Storm Irma, continues. The 400-mile-wide storm has left behind a trail of damage in Florida, and it'll be moving up into the southeastern United States today. And On Point, we'll take a look at what's going on and fill you in on all of that when they continue with our coverage this morning at 10. We're coming right back.
What can be done to compel Charlottesians to regularly be with residents of different races, classes, lifestyles, and beliefs? A listener submitted that question to the WFAE newsroom through our Ask Us feature, and we'd like to hear your thoughts on the topic. Have you found ways to interact with people different from you? What gets you there, or what gets in the way? Share your thoughts by leaving a message at 704-879-3536 or by going online to WFAE.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Mark Boone is with us, spokesperson for the Charlotte-Mecklenburg Stormwater Services Department. Let's talk about what preparations you have that you go through in advance of when you know a hurricane might have us in its eye, in its sights.
Sure. Operationally, we have our list of hotspots that we go out and by hand, and we look and make sure that those areas don't have clogs in the creeks, whether it's down limbs, down trees. Beaver dams is another culprit. And all these things can cause upstream flooding because of downstream blockages.
And you say you have 50 or 60 usual suspects that
That's
are
right.
major creek crossings that tend to collect debris. Don't go through all 50, but where are some of them?
Well,
and why?
Sure. Anything can cause a significant blockage.
Uh-huh.
And so what we are looking for is we're looking to make sure that there's nothing that's impeding water flow or restricting water flow. In addition to those, we are asking folks that have storm drains on their property to please be a good neighbor, go out and sweep it or rake it clear. It only takes like 2 minutes mm-hmm. to clear it. But when those things are clogged, it can cause backup. We have 200,000 of those.
Wow.
And so we have to rely on homeowners and property owners to take a look and make sure they're clear.
Your organization, Stormwater Services, has run announcements on this and other stations talking about turn around, don't drown, about not driving through areas that are flooded because you don't know what's in that water and you don't know how deep it is and you don't know how strong the current is if it's flowing over the water. Do you think that events like Harvey have taught people that lesson?
We hope so. We certainly do hope so. We mentioned the flood in Columbia, and one of my dad's best friends wasn't aware of flooding and got into his car and drove. And unfortunately, he became a fatality in Columbia. He was on his way to church the next morning and just did not know. So we're hoping that here in Mecklenburg County, at least folks know that message. But, you know, when you're driving and you see water on the road, you don't know if the road's even there anymore. We saw that also in Columbia where the floodwaters had washed away the road underneath, and you couldn't see that.
So you would have gone way into the water because the road would have just dropped out from under you.
The majority of fatalities and weather events are from people driving and flooding.
So you make preparations in advance of storms. You're there to respond during storms in various different ways. What happens after the storm is gone?
Well, after the storm is gone, we actually work after the storm is gone, the waters don't necessarily recede
right.
that quickly. The water is still headed our way. And so we work with our first responders. We do have a flood warning system that notifies our first responders if flooding is headed toward a particular area, and they will either evacuate or they will shut down roads in that area.
Mm-hmm.
We work with our partners in the Red Cross, and we work to make sure that folks have the information they need, especially if they become a victim to a flood.
Here's some good news. Let's put some good news in this program. FEMA ranks Charlotte highest among major cities for flood risk management, which results in lower insurance premiums for policyholders. How did we achieve this?
That's a very deliberate effort. We've been working 24 years to prepare for this storm. And I can say that because we have worked with the development community, the real estate community to say, hey, this is something the floodplain or the floodwaters in Charlotte that could come.
Mm-hmm.
We need to watch our development and make sure that we include specifics in order to elevate folks to where they won't become flooded. That included creating a freeboard where we asked people to build a foot over the floodplain, or excuse me, the base flood elevation, mm-hmm. as well as buying out homes that are in the floodplain and other tactics. That recognition from FEMA is relatively new. We're very proud of it.
Okay.
And it does relate to 30% discount for folks who are in the floodplain.
Well, let me thank you for all of us then. Mark Boone is a spokesperson for the Charlotte-Mecklenburg Stormwater Services Department. Thanks for joining us this morning. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Officials always remind us to have emergency supplies on hand and to make a plan in advance about what to do if we have to leave our homes quickly, plans to meet up and make contact with loved ones in times of emergency. I would wager, however, that despite all of those warnings, most of us, including me, have never taken them to heart. So we're going to hear more about that kind of standard preparation, what kind of things you should be doing, and how to make certain decisions before, during, and after emergencies. Angela Broom-Powley is the Regional Chief Executive Officer for the Western North Carolina region of the American Red Cross. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, Mike.
Good to see you. Although Irma got all the attention this week, and it's creating its own set of need. The people affected by Harvey are still suffering, and the Red Cross is there. You will be, I'm sure, in Florida if you're not there already. How great is the need at the Red Cross right now?
Well, we are there. We're 3,000 strong in Texas and over 1,500 strong in Florida. At Georgia, South Carolina, and here in North Carolina, we have been preparing for Irma for weeks as we responded to Harvey and then prepared for Irma to come
through. And what do you need?
Well, we always need volunteers. So the American Red Cross is a volunteer-led organization. 90% of the folks on the ground responding to these disasters are volunteers. So it's Americans helping Americans. It's your American Red Cross. And so if you want to get involved, Come become a trained volunteer with the Red Cross, and then you can help in your community. We have 5 shelters in North Carolina right now. It takes people to man those shelters for evacuees. And if you want to get trained to go and help in other communities, we can do that as well for you.
I'm flabbergasted. You never use the word money.
Well, definitely money. Well, you know, first we have to have the people. Right. The people have to be on the ground to do this. And then we do have to be financially funded. We are not a government organization.
So you need donations. You need infusions of money. But do you also need donations of goods and services?
You know, that's a question we always get. Mm-hmm. It's hard when people bring that bag of clothing that they want to send to Texas. The logistics of that is great, right? Mm-hmm. To sort it, to clean it, and to transport it is very expensive.
Right.
And so what's better is if we do have financial donations that we can invest into that community that needs the funds. And so we all –
because they know what they need.
They know what they need. And so actually Texas Emergency Management has said, please don't send anything more donated items because now you have mounds of things that can't be distributed, and it becomes a logistical issue.
So from your experience at the Red Cross and others that you've worked with, how prepared is the average person for things like Harvey and Irma?
Well, I think you answered that question when you said you've never prepared, Mike.
Never prepared.
And we find that's the case. We like to say the first 72 should be on you. The first 72 hours, you should be able to take care of your family, whether you're sheltering in place or whether you're leaving your home.
And what does that mean? How should I prepare? I mean, we always – when it snows, mm-hmm. when the first flake falls, there's mm-hmm. no bread, there's no milk in the grocery store. With this storm, all the bottled water suddenly evaporated.
Right.
What should we do?
You should have a gallon of water for each person in your family for those first 72 hours, for each day. You should think about canned goods. If your power is not working.
Let me stop you before we move on to canned goods. Mm-hmm. Water.
Water.
Do you have to go and buy a gallon of bottled water, or can you just take it out of the tap before the storm hits?
Turn on your faucet, fill up a jug, and sit it on the counter. Yes, you know, you don't have to have that bottled water from the store. We have, as you heard, great water here in Charlotte, so fill it up. And, you know, fill up some jugs, sit it on the counter, but a gallon per person. Canned goods. Make sure that you have your canned goods and a can opener, because you may not be able to cook.
But also not an electric
one. Not an electric one. The old-timey ones that mm-hmm. most probably – kids now won't even know what that is. But, yeah, make sure you have food, shelf-stable food as well, nothing that's going to be perishable. Make sure you have the necessary medication that you might need for several days. You have pets. Make sure the pets have what they need as well, food, water, and the medical things that you might need to take with you, your glasses and those kind of things. Also, write your phone numbers down. I know, like most of us, we have everything in our phone, and I couldn't tell you a phone number now if I had to,
right. But
I have it all written down, copies of all your important documents. One, I would keep all of that in an emergency kit in your home so that you can have it there if you need it, or if you have to leave, pick it up and take it with you.
When you talk about important papers, what are you talking about?
Your identification, a little bit of extra cash, maybe some information, your insurance policy. If your home is affected and you're not in your home, you're staying in a shelter or with friends, you want to be able to call your agent. You might not have that in front of you.
And now with the cloud, mm-hmm. whether you're an Apple person and you put it in the Apple mm-hmm. thing, or you're a Microsoft person and you stick it on OneDrive or your Dropbox, you still need access to some of those things, mm-hmm. and maybe the phone system is down, or you won't have access to a computer. So
right.
you're saying not
Old
only make
school.
Copies and send it to the cloud so you'll always have it there, mm-hmm. if it's secure there, but also carry it with you.
You know, put it on a few pieces of paper, fold it up, put it in a Ziploc bag so it's protected from water as mm-hmm. well, and take it with you. Yes, think a little old school. What would you have done 20 years ago when you didn't have the cloud or your phone holding your phone numbers?
Are the preparations for hurricanes and extraordinary events like heavy snowfalls or fires or windstorms or whatever it may be, are they the same pretty much?
Pretty much. Pretty much you're going to need the food, water, warm clothes, or ability to get dry. Those kind of things are going to be consistent no matter what.
So I also read in some of your literature that these emergency preparedness kits where you can just grab and go
mm-hmm.
should be in your house.
Mm-hmm.
They should be in your car.
In your car, yes.
They should be at work.
Mm-hmm.
At
yeah.
work.
At work. Well, you know, I remember being in a snowstorm a few years ago, well, probably 10 years ago now, in downtown Charlotte where I was working. And I got in the car to go home, and it took me 3.5 hours to go 12 miles. I really wished I had some food in my car at that point, because that was a long I left around 11, didn't get home till late in the afternoon, and had nothing in the car with me. And if I had have ran out of gas and had mm-hmm. been on the side of the road, I really would have wanted a blanket or something to keep warm, so, or some water to drink. So yeah, small kit in your car, very important.
But some of this stuff, I mean, you want non-perishable food, but even that over time.
Yes, you need to check your kit on a regular basis. At least once a year, go into your kit, check mm-hmm. the expiration dates, and then change out things. Phone numbers may have changed, right? Check those,
right.
change those. So take a look at it. Check on it on a regular basis
year. A lot of people got flooded out in Harvey mm-hmm. and knew maybe that the water was coming, put a lot of their prized possessions, their valuables on top of the bed, and then left the house thinking, well, it's not going to get much higher than the bed. Those things will be fine. Mm-hmm. Only to come back and discover that it came up to the yeah. ceiling in the first floor. So if you have a second floor, should you just put everything on the second floor, or should you take the really important stuff and put it in the attic?
You know, I don't know that there's ever a good answer. So, yes, the higher that you can get things, the better off you're going to be. But remember, those are things. What's important is you and your family. Heed the warnings of emergency officials when they say leave. Leave. Evacuate if they ask you to evacuate. They're giving you good information, and we hope you follow that. But those are things, and those can all be replaced, but your family and your loved ones cannot.
You know, they talk about having evacuation plans in case your house catches on fire, and if you have a 2 or 3-story house, mm-hmm. evacuation ladders in case you can't go down the staircase, throw the ladders out the window and you climb down. I don't know anybody in my life who has those, but we should all have them, I suppose. But what about formulating plans for meeting up somewhere? Because sometimes in these extraordinary events that take whole cities by surprise, like Harvey, families get separated. Dad's at work, mom has to take the kids, or the vice versa, and mm-hmm. they don't know where each other is. Maybe the cell system goes down. What kind of plan should you have for meeting up?
Well, sit down and talk with your family. have that plan. If it's a home fire, where outside of your home are you all going to meet? Because somebody might have gone out the front door, somebody else went out the back. You're all wandering around trying to find each other. And unfortunately, so many times people go back in looking for someone. Right. So have a plan for where you meet at home if there's a home fire, or if you have to evacuate. You're exactly right. The kids are at school. You're in one location. Your spouse is in another one. Where would you go? Where would you meet up? You know, maybe it's grandma's house across town. Maybe you know who's going to get what kid at what school.
Mm-hmm.
Talk to each other. Sit down and have a conversation about what would we do.
There still may be some power outages because we're getting 35, 40 mile per hour winds today from the remnants of Irma. And that means power goes out, your freezer goes out, your refrigerator goes out. How do you know if the food, once the power comes back on, is going to be good?
Well, it's probably how long the power is going to be out. So, you know, if it's just a few hours and the door to the refrigerator was closed. Keep it closed, and the food's probably going to be okay. But if you go a day or two, then more than likely that food's going to start to spoil. And so you probably don't want to partake of that. You probably want to go ahead and think about replacing it.
And I read that one good thing to do, if you know it's coming, like if you lived in Florida and you knew Irma was coming, that you would take your refrigerator and your freezer and you'd turn the temperature much lower than you would normally turn it in advance of the storm so that everything in there is super cold when it goes out, the power goes out. And I read also that one interesting thing you can do is freeze a plastic cup of water, put it in the freezer with a quarter on top of it.
Mm-hmm.
And when the power goes out, when you open and it goes out and then the power comes back on, if you open the freezer and the quarter is now refrozen, but it's in the water, The food went bad.
I haven't heard that one, but yeah, that makes sense because that means the water, it got too cool in there and the water was no longer frozen. So that's interesting, but it makes sense to me.
So now, if we were all to do these things, many of us would feel foolish, like we're overkill. Should we feel foolish?
You should not at all. I don't think if anyone in Florida had done this preparedness, they would be feeling foolish right now, or folks in Texas had evacuated. Think about how many people felt foolish when they had to be rescued by boat.
Is there a place to go at the American Red Cross website that has this information?
Redcross.org. We'll find you can get all this information there.
And you need volunteers.
Always.
Okay. Angela Broom-Powley, Regional Chief Executive Officer for the Western North Carolina region of the American Red Cross. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Hopefully we never need any of the things that we talked about here today.
I hope that you don't.
Thank you.